Hello and welcome to Next Week in Your Practice Session. In this session, Bill O'Hanlon joins Drs. Rick Hansen and Ruth Baczynski to give you concrete strategies you can use in your life and work with patients. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist, inspirational speaker, and author of more than 35 books. Welcome to Next Week in Your Practice.
Okay, let's start as we always do. What stood out to you most in the webinar?
I think Dan's really done a great public service here by reframing how we think about adolescence. If you want to insult somebody, say, oh, you're being so adolescent about it, right? And it's hard to get respect. And one of the things we do with teenagers is we sort of sequester them in these reservations, right, malls and schools, and we take them out of adulthood. And then we expect them to, you know, work hard and give up all kinds of fun things for at least 10 years so they can have a life like our own. And to them, that's kind of crazy. So what I think Dan's really done here is reframe adolescence as this wonderful, positive period of development that can have sometimes too much of a good thing that we need to be, you know, thoughtful about. But it's a way to see adolescence in this very positive way. The brain's changing, new capacities are developing, and I was really happy to see him do that.
How about you, Bill? What stood out most to you?
Well, I'm sort of riding on that, normalizing adolescence rather than pathologizing and saying this is this terrible thing. I remember, you know, I grew up in a big family, 8 kids, and I remember when I moved back home after I'd been away to college, and I went out to a Christmas concert with my mother, and my father was gone by then, and my youngest brother, the eighth one of us. I was a middle kid, so I was about the fourth one. And we went out, and on the way home, my brother just went off on my mother saying how dumb she was and how she didn't know anything and how this. And I was sitting in the back seat just appalled. And then she dropped him off at home and drove me to my home. And she was going to go back home in a few minutes. And I said, wow, you stayed so calm during that. How did you? She said, he's the eighth one. They all go through this. So she knew what Dan Siegel said years ago. He said, they all think you're the stupidest person, don't know anything, and they push away from you at a certain point. She said, I just couldn't get that excited about it this time. I've gone through it 7 times before. And I thought, oh, I hope I get that perspective when I have kids, because I'm sure it hurts. But, you know, here's the thing. I loved also the takeaway from me, what Dan Siegel said was, this is useful evolutionarily. It explains, you know, humans and cockroaches have covered the planet. We live in all the environments in the planet. I'm sure there are cockroaches in Antarctica right now. They're surviving, and on the East Coast. They're surviving this terrible weather that we're having at the moment. But the reason we do that is because we go out and go into new environments. And just having that perspective can relax you a little about either you going through adolescence, as Dan wants to help the adolescents, or other people around them, teachers, parents, counselors, anybody who deals with adolescents. I thought that was a great service to humanity and teenagers, as you said, Rick. You know, shouldn't use it as a pejorative term anymore, adolescents. Mm.
So in the teenage brain, their limbic area has them basically seeking danger, and we know that they're less likely to calculate accurately the downside of any decision that they might be considering. Given all that, how do we teach them to make good decisions, good and safe decisions?
Yeah. Well, first, I think it's helpful to appreciate, obviously, that there's a lot of normal variation. I think many teenagers are quite cautious, conscientious. They worry about the future. That said, certainly on the average, there is that tendency toward risky behaviors. And two things struck me about that. One is that for all their emotionality, my own experience of working with adolescents, I worked with quite a lot of teenagers, is that they often lack self-compassion. In other words, they're often quite good about really feeling for their friends, and they're loyal to their friends. I'll get to that one in a second. But they're not very compassionate for themselves. So in terms of having more of a grounded sense, you know, Dan talks about more of a opening to a kind of a bottom-up wisdom about the actual risks that could occur for you in a situation, driving with others, using drugs, sexual activities, emotional outbursts, blowing off high school, whatnot. One way, I think, to help adolescents deal with that in a more grounded way is to open to compassion for themselves, to have more of a caring attitude. Mm-hmm. Often adolescents are harshly self-critical rather than kind to themselves. And then the second thing quickly is about loyalty. Adolescents also tend to be very, very loyal to their particular peeps, if you will, you know, their type. Well, they can extend that same loyalty to the person they will become, the one who will be impacted by going driving with someone who's drunk or blowing off high school. And they can tap that powerful capacity for loyalty that's present in adolescence to have loyalty to the one being that they have the most power over, which is, of course, their future self.
That's a very interesting idea, Rick. So, Bill, we've said that the limbic brain is pushing them toward danger and that they're not great at evaluating the downside of certain decisions that they make. On top of that, there's processes in the brain that are pushing them to push away from their parents. So can we just stay with this a little longer? How do we help the teenager make good decisions, given all of that?
Well, since I raised four of them, I have some ideas about this. And, you know, one of the things I used to say to my kids, so I think it's partly about values and ethics and modeling. One of the things I used to say to my kids is, look, if you get bad grades, that can be fixed. If you get pregnant, you know, or get somebody pregnant, that, you know, that we can deal with. If you drive drunk or you're in a car with somebody drunk and you die, we can't fix that. So let's have some parameters of the risky things you're going to do. There are certain things that we can't recover from. Other things we can. So I think partly making some boundaries. I think also modeling good values and good ethics. You know, as Rick said, I know adolescents that act very well, you know, even though they have that stuff going on, the changes and the risky stuff, they keep their risks within a certain parameter because they've had good role models and good values instilled in them. And, you know, I think that also you could give them something to rebel about that isn't so scary and dangerous. I'll just give you two quick examples. I had a nephew who was in big trouble, one of those troubled adolescents who was just spinning out of control, and somehow he got into a treatment program which was Christian-based, and they took him down to Haiti as part of their vacation trip, and he turned around. When he met those kids in Haiti, and that was, I'm sure, a scary experience for him. It was dangerous to be down there. It was after the earthquake. But he was able to help other kids. I saw these pictures, these kids just all over him and a big smile on his face. And I had met him 6 months before, and there was no smile on his face. So he was doing something risky and different and dangerous in a different country, but it was of service. So I thought that was great. And it reminded me of a mutual friend of ours, Ruth, Rob Garrett, who's a psychiatrist and sponsors workshops. And he went on a trip like that as an adolescent. He went to Europe. And he was from this small town on the East Coast, and his whole world just opened up. It was the scariest thing he'd ever done to that point, and he decided to become a physician out of that trip. And I thought, wow, you give him something scary to do that's not so dangerous. It's sort of risky, but it's not physically dangerous.
Very interesting. Rick, Dan mentions that self-awareness can help the teenager make better decisions. So given that, how do we help them increase or improve their self-awareness? How can we teach self-awareness? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. On the one hand, as Dan talks about, there's a spurt of neurological development in regions of the brain, like the insula, for example, that are involved with self-awareness. So on the one hand, Mother Nature's on our side there. On the other hand, I think for a variety of reasons, many of the adolescents I've known, in a funny kind of way, there's like a flight away from their innermost feelings and their innermost sensations and innermost, deepest, most soulful desires. I think in part because they can be intense at that age, and also sometimes they're negative or there's a fair amount of pain down there. So the question then becomes, to actually help adolescents come home to themselves. You know, they look very sensation-seeking, pleasure-seeking from the outside, but from the inside, I think there's actually a lot of inner alienation from their own core. So one way into that is to encourage an ongoing awareness of just basic body sensations, like the sensations of breathing, particularly more the internal sensations of breathing, like a sense of the chest rising and falling, or the air coming in cool and leaving warm, for example. The other thing is to really actually register or feel or stay with feelings of pleasure in the body. Again, I think the body is this kind of alien continent for a lot of adolescents, a lot of teenagers, and early people even in their early 20s. But in fact, if they can notice that, especially more wholesome pleasures, you know, curling up with a cat, cuddling your friend, eating something good, you know, taking a shower, kind of finally getting to bed, you know, those kind of basic ordinary pleasures. Pleasure can be a pathway into self-awareness that's rewarding for adolescents, and therefore it'll motivate them more to come down into themselves.
Thanks, Rick. Bill, one thing that teenagers have is this incredible sense of creativity. Is there a way we could use that?
Yeah, I think, again, that growth spurt, you know, at that point that Dan Siegel was talking about can be channeled, as I was saying, you know, these kind of risky activities. It can also be channeled in those creative directions. And I think music and art and dance and writing, I know that, you know, I played music when I was an adolescent. I both listened to it, but I also played it. And it was a great outlet for me. It was a really good way to connect with myself and do some of that self-awareness that Rick was talking about, I think. And it was a way to channel that, you know, I'm unique and nobody understands me, all that kind of stuff, because I would find songs that would be like that, and I would write songs that would be like that. So I think finding a creative outlet, and I know, you know, there's been some complaints in the U.S. that we're cutting arts programs, and you know, to link this back to the brain, we know that learning music is a whole brain growth experience. It's an integrative experience and a whole brain growth experience. So I like the music part of it, but dance, obviously, because it has rhythm and music to it, typically. Writing can do something like that. Art can do something like that. But my favorite is music. So if you can expose kids to music, and obviously, when I am a therapist and I have a kid come in, I say, bring me in your favorite music, and a whole different kid shows up in my office. So connecting with kids through music, and I connected with my kids, they liked some of the music that I liked. They liked the Beatles, you know, which was my group, my era, and they learned to like them. So it was a little bit of a bridge, I think, through music. So I recommend music.
Okay. Rick, this whole idea of a growth spurt, Dan brought it up Wednesday night, Bill's referred to it. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Is that something that you, when you look at the literature and your experience in working with so many kids, is that your sense that they have that their brains go through a growth spurt?
Right. It looks like there's a kind of a burst of activity in the subcortical regions of the brain, the limbic system often called, which correlates with this increase in a sense of passion, as Bill was saying, emotionality, overflowing feelings. Everything's really big when you're an adolescent, right? I certainly remember that well. But there's not an equivalent growth spurt in the prefrontal regions that are involved in regulation. So it's a little bit like suddenly this car has the same size brakes, but has suddenly been installed a Corvette, you know, super-duper turbocharged engine, right? And so what that means for me is a corollary. It's kind of two things with adolescents and with their families that I get engaged with. On the one hand, it's really appreciating those passions and not squelching them too quickly, you know, looking for channels for them to flow to some extent, but not being so alarmed by the intensity that can come out. And instead, you know, be more chill about it, frankly. So thinking back to Bill's mom, you know, by the time she got to the eighth one, she was definitely a lot more chill about it. She could put it in perspective. So, and to honor those passions, you know, to respect them, to not trivialize them, or to put them down as many adults do when they hear about the passions of teenagers, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, if you're riding some old plow horse, you don't need to be a very competent rider. You don't need very many skills. You could be half asleep and that horse will still get you back to the barn. But if you're on top of some jumpy thoroughbred, you know, that really reacts to every little thing and can go a million miles an hour, you've got to be a much more skillful rider. And I'll use that analogy with adolescence. You know, you've got a thoroughbred now. This is a really passionate, powerful, big animal that your inner being is. You need to become a little bit more skillful as a rider, because when you're a little bit more skillful, you can have a lot more fun. A little different example is, I'll use it with people, imagine having a bicycle with no brakes. You know, a bicycle with no brakes, you can't ride very fast. You've got to be kind of cautious. But if you get some brakes in your bicycle, you could do all kinds of really cool things with it, including flips and all kinds of fun things. So if you're going to have these passions, a little bit of skillfulness, a little bit of self-knowledge, a little bit of self-regulation can go a long way. And then at that point, we're in the conversation about, okay, how can I be a little more skillful so I can have more fun with this big passionate horse now? And then I've got an adolescent who's much more motivated to learn about things like mindfulness or self-awareness, a little bit of relaxing, a little bit of calming, a little bit of impulse control. And then they realize, okay, I'm motivated to do this from the inside out. I've bought in, because being more skillful with my own inner horse, if you will, is going to enable me to go to a lot more neat places.
Thanks, Rick. Last question, and this is for you, Bill. We've talked about, Dan talked about how the teenager will shift from the parents to their peers in terms of who influences them. How does that affect their appraisal system?
Well, I think that, you know, I was trained as a family therapist, and I remember this guy, the family therapist that I heard talk one time, and he said, you know, sometimes I'll try and engage the adolescents in therapy, and it's just not working. They're just, you know, I don't want to hear what you have to say. They're very resistant. So I'll bring in their families, and they're alienated from their families, and I can't engage them yet. And then I call in what I call their second family. That's their best friends. And I get two or three of them. And as Rick was saying earlier, those kids, for themselves, they may not have a good perspective, but for their friends, they're very compassionate, and they're actually pretty wise. So I think that's one thing, is you say, you know, the friends will say, you know, you got to listen to this counselor, because you are getting drunk every night, and you have a problem. And if you told them that directly, or if their friends try to tell them that directly right away, it wouldn't work. But somehow in that environment, you're changing their mind, because you've engaged that second family, the people that are really important to them. So I think that's one of the things, is find those positively influential friends, not the negative ones, not the ones who say, yeah, let's shoot up. Not those people, but the positively influential friends, and get them to come in, I think, because again, the environment that's around the kid, both the one that you provided when they were growing up, and as Rick said, this isn't something that happens over a year or two. It's something that happens over 20 years or 25 years or 16 years. And so you don't have to worry, you know, that you have to do everything in this one moment. You've laid a background, and hopefully you've laid an ethical and value system where they'll seek out those people that are kind to them and that are caring about them and that will help influence them. And you can influence those kids too when you engage them, and don't say you shouldn't be hanging around with this person. You can find the best of them. It's sort of like Rick Hansen, always go for the good and take in the good. Well, you're going to look for that in social systems as well, their second family.
So I'm sorry, we're going to have to wrap up now.
Thank you for watching this session. We hope you'll go ahead and take these ideas and begin using them in your work. In part 4, you'll find your Quick Start Guide. It's an at-a-glance reference to the most critical concepts and practices from this short course. You'll be able to use this to refresh your memory, so you'll feel confident in turning these insights into action. And in part 5, you'll find the transcripts. You'll be able to download, print, and refer to these professionally formatted transcripts as often as you like. Thanks again for watching.